This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, January 10th, 2008. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, a sick poem by Sylvia Plath. Sylvia Plath's story is better known than her poems, which are often read as a kind of emotional roadmap to her suicide at the age of 30, especially the poems she wrote in the final months of her life, which Robert Lowell called her appalling and triumphant fulfillment. But knowing her story doesn't really help us with her poems. In fact, the Sylvia Plath myth probably obscures her enormous achievement. J.D. McClatchy has said, "No poet in the second half of the 20th century made English sound more terrifying and more ecstatic." We're going to hear the terror and ecstasy in one of the last poems she wrote.
Fever, 103.
And here to help us through its complexities is poet Carrie Wason, who wrote a reading guide of the poem for our website, poetryfoundation.org. She joins me from KUOW in Seattle. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Curtis.
So we have a recording that we're going to hear shortly of Plath reading the poem herself. But first I wanted to ask you, do you think it's possible or even desirable to read Sylvia Plath's poems without bringing her biography into it?
You know, I, like many people, knew her story before or alongside the poetry. So I have never had the experience of reading her work without knowing about her end.
Yeah, it's really hard to read a lot of her poems, especially the darker poems, mm-hmm. without injecting what you know of her biography into it.
I do know that I started out writing as an adolescent, and like many adolescents, turned to Plath's work because I was attracted to the angst of it.
Or the narcissism of it.
Exactly, which is true of a lot of poetry, actually. But I have returned to her work as an adult with some distance from that kind of depression myself. And the work stands even stronger. The poems remain just lacerating is the term that always comes up for me.
Okay, so Fever 103 is not an especially easy poem. It's not overly difficult, but it's not going to be easy for people to get on the first hearing if they haven't read it before. Mm-hmm. It moves through a series of complex images and references. Mm-hmm. Can you help set it up a bit and give listeners something to hang their hats on before we hear her read it?
For me, the title says it all. Here is a speaker speaking to us out of a fever, out of a very high fever.
Yeah, 103 is really, it's a bad fever.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there is a tension here between hell and heaven, between being nothing and being everything. That when you speak about narcissism before, you know, the flip sides of that coin, you know, I am nothing or I am everything.
Yeah, you can almost hear it as the first half as being sort of a poem of depression and the second half being kind of a manic poem of ecstasy. Almost.
Exactly.
It's a manic depressive poem, I guess you could, is one way to say it. So let's hear the poem, which Sylvia Plath recorded on October 30th, 1962.
Fever, 103. Pure, what does it mean? The tongues of hell are dull, dull as the triple tongues of dull fat Cerberus who wheezes at the gate. Incapable of licking clean the ague tendon, the sin. The tinder cries, the indelible smell of a snuffed candle. Love, love. The low smokes roll from me like Isadora's scarves. I'm in a fright one scarf will catch an anchor in the wheel. Such yellow sullen smokes make their own element. They will not rise, but trundle round the globe, choking the aged and the meek, the weak hothouse baby in its crib, the ghastly orchid hanging its hanging garden in the air. Devilish leopard. Radiation turned it white and killed it in an hour. Greasing the bodies of adulterers like Hiroshima ash and eating in the sin. Darling, all night I have been flickering, off, on, off, on. The sheets grow heavy as a lecher's kiss. 3 days, 3 nights. Lemon water, chicken water, water make me wretch. I am too pure for you or anyone. Your body hurts me as the world hurts God. I am a lantern. My head a moon of Japanese paper, my gold-beaten skin infinitely delicate and infinitely expensive. Does not my heat astound you, and my light? All by myself I am a huge camellia, glowing and coming and going, flush on flush. I think I am going up. I think I may rise. The beads of hot metal fly, and I, love, I am a pure acetylene virgin, attended by roses, by kisses, by cherubim, by whatever these pink things mean. Not you, nor him, nor him, nor him. Myself dissolving, old whore petticoats, to paradise.
Sylvia Plath reading your poem, Fever 103. Now, as readings go, Carrie, that one is pretty hair-raising, wouldn't you
mm-hmm.
think?
Yes.
Even if you can't follow the sense of the poem all the way through, or a lot of it gets lost on listeners, man.
She means it.
And the maturity of her voice also surprised me. She was only 30 years old when she read that poem.
Mm-hmm. She's picked up a bit of a British accent there,
yeah.
Which I think lends to that the sound of authority.
Because she was living in England with mm-hmm. tattoos for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
She begins it almost, as you say in your reading guide, almost as if she's in the middle of a conversation.
Pure, what does it mean?
It draws us immediately into the poem. She's asking a rhetorical question as though we had just asked her what pure means.
The tongues of hell are dull.
Immediately we think flames.
Right. And the tongues of hell are not, in her poem, flames.
They're actual tongues.
Yeah. they're dog tongues of Cerberus, who, you know, it's not very easy to pull off a classical illusion as she does with any power. And Cerberus, I had to go look it up. Cerberus was the three-headed dog that guarded the gates of Hades.
Mm-hmm.
But her Cerberus is not any ferocious hound. He's somebody else.
Dull, fat Cerberus who wheezes at the gate. Incapable of licking clean the ague tendon.
And I had to go and look up ague as well. Tell us what that means.
It means achy. For me, I remember reading that word as a very young child in the Laura Ingalls Wilder books.
And the ague, right? The fever,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. It's such an onomatopoetic word. For me, it really captures the actual feeling of being sick.
But then this bizarre rhyming repetition,
the ague tendon, the sin.
What do you make of that?
She's using a very simple set of sounds there. There's no fancy rhyme work going on, but she's definitely hitting the same note over and over and over again. Tendon, sin, and then, you know, it goes back to incapable and going on forward into tinder, which goes on to indelible, which goes on to smell.
Yeah.
She's knitting this, you know, we are just tugged along through this ride she's already yanked us along on.
The tinder cries, the indelible smell of a snuffed candle.
I try to take a poem as literally as possible. And she's saying tinder, which to me means wood, burning wood that's actually crying because it's in pain, because it's on fire.
Right.
Which is a terrifying image. And it's coming right after the sin, which, granted, at this point, we have no idea what the sin is.
Right.
And we just have to take it on faith that she's going to do something for us here, and the sounds are taking over to sort of assure us that there is a sense being made here.
Yeah. But then she develops an image that is quite complex and bizarre.
Love, love, the low smokes roll from me like Isadora's scarves. I'm in a fright one scarf will catch an anchor in the wheel.
Isadora Duncan, as I remember, died when her scarf got caught in the back wheel of a convertible.
Another woman who is very famous for her death.
Yeah, but she makes the association of low smoke rolls from me with the mm-hmm. scarf. So you get an image mm-hmm. of smoke on a windy day pushing back down to the surface of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
What is this smoke?
again, we're back with the fever, and she has these poisonous fumes coming off of her that are so much more than just fumes. They are gas, but not just coming off of her in a sort of intangible, unseeable way, but actually in a physical way, like a scarf that she could actually get caught on and might even hang herself off of. She goes on to say,
such yellow sullen smokes make their own element. They will not rise.
Again with those sounds, L's and E's and O's.
But trundle round the globe, choking the aged and the meek.
Trundle. Smoke does not trundle. It's hard to imagine smoke trundling.
It doesn't, and it's something that sticks out for me there. It's part of a puzzle piece that I haven't quite solved. But they are on a mission, and they are working themselves around the globe, choking the aged and the meek. And then she goes into what I think is one of the most stunning pieces of poetry I've ever read.
Choking the aged and the meek, the weak hothouse baby in its crib, the ghastly orchid hanging its hanging garden in the air.
There's nothing fancy sound-wise going on in there, but she's knitting it all together, the meek and the weak, the baby, those E's, the crib and the orchid, the transposition of the adjectives hothouse for baby and ghastly for orchid.
Yeah, you would think it would be hothouse orchid and ghastly.
Ghastly baby.
Ghastly baby, it's pretty.
Which is what she is saying almost, but which is verboten for a mother to say.
Right. So she gets around that by transposing it, but making the association.
Mm-hmm.
And then goes on to greasing. And this smoke or this scarf smoke coming from her body, also greasing
the bodies of adulterers like Hiroshima ash and eating in the sin, the sin.
This is a piece of the poem that I have to make myself comfortable letting be loose in terms of actual specific meaning.
And it is a fever poem.
And she's not that into explaining herself at this point.
Yeah. But then all of a sudden there's a shift in the poem. And it, as you point out in your essay, it seems to return back to the normal.
Darling, all night I have been flickering off. On, off, on. The sheets grow heavy as a lecher's kiss.
As a lecher's kiss, which is...
Which is so wonderful.
Yeah, one can sense that super sensitivity on one's skin when you feel really fevery and the repulsion of the physical
just
world.
Just get off me, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
It is marvelous. And then she has a very clear image of her sickness.
3 days, 3 nights. Lemon water, chicken water, water make me rich.
Then the poem changes from this, I guess, depressive, since we talked about it earlier, depressive mode into a kind of manic mode where she brought up the question of purity at the top, and now she's saying,
I am too pure for you or anyone. Your body hurts me as the world hurts God.
It's almost as though she's arguing with someone and she has gotten to a peak with her image of the Hiroshima ash and eating in, and she decides to stop and make nice for a second. Darling, all night I've been flickering off and on as a way of excuse. This is what I'm dealing with.
Uh-huh.
I've been living on lemon water and chicken water. I want to retch.
Yeah.
But she can only hold it for two stanzas before she turns around with that bite, and I am too pure for you or anyone.
Yeah.
And then talk about grandiosity. Yeah. Your body hurts me as the world hurts God. The equation in that metaphor is your body is the world and I am God.
Yeah. The narcissism there is powerful.
I am God.
It's
powerful. I am God. It doesn't get bigger than that. And not only that, I am God and I am a lantern.
I am a lantern. My head a moon of Japanese paper, my gold-beaten skin infinitely delicate and infinitely expensive. Does not my heat astound you?
She's going nuts here.
Yeah, it's almost a Whitmanian, Walt Whitman boast about her powers as a poet. And then she compares herself to a huge flower.
All by myself, I am a huge camellia, glowing and coming and going, flush on flush.
I'd like to say something, too, about the I ams. She is saying over and over again what she is, and she's piling image on top of image, but she doesn't end with God. She starts with God. I am God, and then I am a lantern,
yeah,
and then I am a planet, and then I am paper,
right.
And then I am gold, and then I am heat and light, I am a flower.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's, all of these things are on the same level as though they are all equal.
And so what do you make of that sort of her series of associations there?
I think that she is transforming herself. I think she is actually transforming herself there. If any poem has actual power, this poem does. And there is something here that is actually working as some sort of incantatory magic. And she's doing it with sounds, and she's doing it with images, and she's doing it with insistence.
So in this high fever, here she is reimagining her own identity, and not as something kind of earthly, but as something extraordinarily powerful and beautiful.
And maybe crazy, but who cares? Because I'm bigger than you or anyone.
Yeah, and then and then it does verge towards craziness.
Mm-hmm. I think I am going up.
I think I am going up. I think I may rise. The beads of hot metal fly, and I, love, I am a pure acetylene virgin, attended by roses, by kisses, by cherubim, by whatever these pink things mean.
There's an actual liftoff here.
Yeah. There's also a sense when she says, I am a pure acetylene virgin, it's almost, I would hate to say it because I don't think she intended this, but there's something campy about that.
You know, I agree. The whole ending is somewhat campy. We have the stock image of the virgin rising up.
By roses, yeah.
Attended by roses, kisses by cherubim.
I think she may be saying it with this highly charged irony. I can't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It must be.
An acetylene virgin. Acetylene is a welding flame, right? Is it a flame?
It's a flame that, it's a gas,
right,
actually, that can cut through metal.
Right.
So we have the elements changing. You know, metal is now in liquid form. The beads of hot metal fly, and she is a gas that is capable of cutting through something as solid as metal.
Yeah.
And she is rising up like the Virgin Mary. And I love the line, by whatever these pink things mean. She doesn't even try there.
Yeah.
They could mean anything.
They could mean spots on her body. They could mean,
exactly.
Yeah.
But they certainly don't mean you, and they don't mean him.
Not you, nor him, nor him, nor him.
We hear the use of the word him as in hymnal, as well as the pronoun.
My cells dissolving, old whore petticoats, to paradise.
The poem kind of dissolves at this point.
Yeah.
I may rise to paradise is the shortcut of that sentence. And it's a word, paradise is, again, a stock word, like pure, which is the word that she begins the poem with. And she has gone from two very, very abstract concepts into the body of the poem, which is very, 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 very specific. And then the poem dissolves back into abstract.
Yeah. You know, I think about this poem now, it seems so witchy to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I could have...
Incantatory is the word that I think really works with this poem. It is repetition that actually does something. It actually makes something. The power of repetition. She's repeating her sounds, and she's repeating a sentiment over and over again, which is pain. And there is power in that.
Carrie Wason, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carrie Wason is a poet in Seattle. One of her poems is included in Best American Poetry of 2007. You can find her reading guide on our website, poetryfoundation.org, where you'll find other reading guides and articles and an archive of thousands of poems and some new poetry podcasts. The audio of Fever 103 Degrees comes from The Voice of the Poet, Sylvia Plath, published by Random House. The Voice of the Poet series is edited by J.D. McClatchy, and each volume in the series includes a book and a CD, both of which are wonderful introductions to the poets they feature. Do let us know what you think of this program, where our motto is...
You should never explain a poem, but it always helps nevertheless.
Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.